I'm Mark Hennick. This is So-Called Normal.
Those who live with a mental illness will be the first to tell you that living a life that is full and happy and joyful, it can be work. It's work because that's what it takes to work your way through diagnosis and treatment. Then, arming yourself with the tools necessary to handle a relapse if and when it occurs. Shelley knows firsthand what's involved in the road to happiness while living with a mental illness.
I am, and I don't mind saying it, a 46-year-old mom and partner, and I'm a graphic designer by trade, but I have some issues with cognitive things that have come up from treatments from the past. My family owns 3 family businesses, so we're always busy. I have a 16-year-old son. I'm just a normal, everyday person who's swimming through life as best as she can.
Yeah. But it hasn't always been that way, though, of course.
And I still don't think it is, but I think that this has been part of me since I was born. I think there's a part of me that knows that whether it was because I was premature and my mom often thinks that she did something wrong, there's just a little part of my brain that doesn't work the way it should. And many of us are born with organs that don't function optimally. And I just think it took a long time to figure out that that might be the case for me.
When did things start to become evident that there might be something wrong?
I personally noticed when I was about 5 or 6 years old that I wasn't feeling like everybody else around me did. Kids were always happy and carefree, and that wasn't me. I learned really quickly that people are really uncomfortable around tears and kids who are crying all the time. So I just felt super emotional and super affected and sad all the time. And I had one principal who noticed. And he asked my parents to bring me to a psychiatrist, and that psychiatrist basically said, she needs to be toughened up, send her to school when she's sick. I don't care if she has a temperature of 105, she's just too sensitive. So that was the course that was set for the next 15 years after that. And therefore I learned to hide it, and I was wearing a mask by the time I was 6 and doing everything I could to make sure nobody else felt the way I did.
Did your parents understand what was going on with you, do you think?
My mom, in hindsight, says that she recognized the way I was as a kid, but back then we didn't talk about mental health, and nor did we really treat it unless you were an adult with some pretty severe issues.
Yeah. What kind of stigma, you know, even just going to a psychiatrist, even now, you know, to a lesser extent now, but certainly not all that long ago, just talking to a psychiatrist, period, was stigmatized, that was not an okay thing to do. Is that your experience as well?
Yes and no. My dad was definitely a pull your socks up, toughen up kind of guy that didn't believe in mental health until my son did his journey. But my mom was the sensitive type, and she definitely didn't push me to do things that I couldn't do or was uncomfortable doing. So outside, no, I didn't receive any of the stigma, not until I was much older and actually actively seeking treatment. Mm.
So then it wasn't until, what, high school when you really started to get treatment?
So I basically say I flew over the radar. I became a straight-A student. I was the teacher's pet. I won all of the citizenship awards. I helped everybody through everything they were going through because I didn't want anyone to know that something wasn't right inside. So I excelled at getting A's, but I really failed at living life happily. It was when I was about 21, I went to my doctor's office and I saw a pamphlet that said, if you have 5 of these 20 symptoms, you might have depression. And I had never really heard of it then. And I had 18 or 19 of the symptoms, and it just kind of went boom. Like, could this be what I have? Could this be what I've been going through? Like, is there an alternative life for me? Could I actually feel these feelings that I'm faking right now?
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing, because when you grow up with it, you don't realize that there is any other way, right?
I knew people didn't like the way I was, so I hid it, but I didn't know there was an opportunity for me to actually have access to all the chemicals that make you feel happy and that make you feel joy and that make you feel excitement and all. I just thought they weren't available to me.
So what did, you know, I'm often fascinated by this, like what people's state of mind is before they have a revelation of sorts or before they figure something out. What did you call, or did you call this thing anything, these feelings that you felt prior to being able to call them depression, prior to the label?
So I'm not really sure, because I don't think just because of the lack of education and the fact that I was still learning, I lived so much behind my mask that I think I was confused about who I was actually. The person I portrayed was a super positive, super excited, super gung-ho on doing everything good. I didn't smoke drugs. I was a prefect at high school. I did everything right, but that was an expectation I put on myself, and it probably caused a lot of issues in the first place. I was never a rule breaker. I was too scared to step outside of my own comfort zone because going there meant that it would be days of being in my room crying, trying to hide from everyone.
Yeah. So when you looked at that pamphlet and realized that you checked off so many of those boxes, what did that feel like to have, you know, that kind of description of your experience?
I'm not sure I remember. I think it was more of a revelation type of, wait a second, I've got this. And it sounded scary and it sounded like forever. And I was still worried about, like you said, the idea of talking to a doctor about mental health, because we didn't do that back then. And so many people were sent away from their families to live at places who had mental illnesses. So it was tough. It was, I should not equate it like this, but it was like coming out. It was like realizing who I was.
So, but you eventually did talk to a doctor about
that. Oh, 100%. I actually made an appointment that day to talk about it.
Wow.
And we started my journey of medication trials.
On that first appointment?
Yeah, on that first appointment.
Wow.
I think I staked my case pretty quick.
First appointment with her doctor, and Shelley begins medication in hopes of correcting whatever was causing the feelings of unhappiness. That's rare. In fact, it can often take weeks, months, even years to find the right combination of treatment. I had the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Christina Iglesia. She's a licensed clinical psychologist based out of the San Francisco Bay Area. It didn't take long for us to pull back the layers in regards to diagnosis.
It's no secret, at least within the mental health community, that diagnosis and treatment is notoriously scattershot in mental health, that we have no idea what the hell works or why it works. Or I mean, from a research perspective, from a university perspective, maybe we have some good correlational data.
Yeah.
But when somebody presents either at an emergency room or their family doc or whatever, there's no test to say which treatment, or there are a few tests to suggest which treatment or what they even have. So how do we navigate that uncertainty? How do both patients and healthcare providers navigate that uncertainty and hopefully reduce the number of darts thrown at the dartboard?
My hope is that people are continuing to stay up in the scientific world of what treatments are working or are more optimal for specific mental health issues versus many of us who just rely on the trial and error approach, right? I think it's our job as clinicians to continue to be advocating for enough modalities where people can come into our office and say, hey, I'm struggling with depression, and we have two or three techniques, interventions, tools that right off the bat, that person can feel relief from. I think that many professionals and providers stick to a very standardized regimen that might work for some people, but are going to be a miss for many people. And so until us as providers take initiative to figuring out what's going on in the medical world, what's going on in the therapy world, and how can we implement that with the people we work with, people are going to continue to show up to providers that are just going to write them the same prescription that they write everyone they see and hope that it works for them.
Employers, insurers, governments even, they're not always as evidence-based as we would like. There's often many different influences on why certain decisions get made, right from the prescription pad all the way through to policy decisions. So how can we help governments, employers, insurers to understand the value of having these new options, different options, even just many options, so that way providers have many different tools in their toolbox?
We have to be willing to change as a system, as a society, as individuals. We have to be willing to look at mental health as something that deserves our attention. And that is everything from when we are funding research. Are we doing that towards mental health? that's everything from when we are discovering new medications. Are we doing that also in mental health? That is everything from when we are voting. Are we voting for policies that are including and taking care of mental health? We have to be continuing to prioritize mental health so that it will seep into the system, such as the workplace, such as government, such as insurance panels. We have to continue to be advocating for this to show up so that eventually it's something that people have to be paying attention to and have to be making decisions about, even in the most basic form, through our right to vote. And how are we doing that with mental health in mind?
The hit and miss administrative approach to the mental health system is reflected in the approach many patients experience when they're prescribed medications. Shelley had her own trial and error experience that's not unique.
So how did you respond to that first medication then, that first try?
To be honest, I'm not 100% sure. I think that I was so hopeful that I had found my answer and this was the answer to that, that I think I made it work, but medications have never, in hindsight, all the different ones I've tried have never worked for me. They've never had a long-term sustaining effect. As a matter of fact, the side effects were so strong, I seem to be really sensitive to them, so.
What kind of side effects would you experience?
Oh my gosh. The brain fog, sleeplessness, insomnia, sometimes physical pain, a lot of abdominal issues. Just the side effects that were kind of hard to live with, heart palpitations, feeling faint, the stuff that isn't the kind of stuff you have to work yourself through, the stuff that the doctors kept saying, yeah, no, we can't let you go through that.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. How many different medications did you try before figuring out it wasn't going to work?
Over the years, I've probably tried between 20 and 30 medications and combinations. Wow. And I've had misdiagnoses in the past. So I've also tried meds that made me more suicidal and made me worse. But it's definitely been a journey.
Had you ever, that's a lot of meds, obviously, along that pathway, stop taking a medication or not want to take a medication because of what it made you feel like?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And it was weird because I can live with the depression because I figured out how to, but I couldn't live with these side effects. So it was that internal battle of, but wait, if I just stick with it and get through the side effects, or if they resolve themselves, then maybe everything else will get better. Mm-hmm. But it just seemed that I had too many issues with the side effects that it wasn't something I was going to get over.
Yeah, and I mean, often they do. Every medication has side effects, of course, but they usually subside after a little while.
Right. Usually. They were just too much that I couldn't handle. And it wasn't making a difference with my major depressive disorder anyway, so.
Right, right. Yeah. Now, were all these different medication trials covered by insurance, or were you paying for them? Or?
I think there may have been two that were not, and they were very expensive ones. I've definitely spent a lot of money over the years with coverage for treatments and such. I've actually never, ever had talk therapy. I've been on waiting lists for 2.5 years at a time, but I have not once in my history had talk therapy outside of being admitted to a hospital. But I think that would be really great to have. I don't even know what that would look like.
Was that ever suggested to you along the way?
All the time. And I requested all the time too. And my doctor would put me on a waiting list, but I never had benefits at those critical times that I could cover it, and I could never afford it.
Right. Well, and this is something that people don't understand, that, you know, talk therapy, according to the research, seems to work just as well for depression as medication for many people. Mm-hmm. But you're going to be paying $150, $200, $250 an hour for that. And sometimes, you know, talk therapy, if it took you 30 or 40 years to get the way you are now, it's not going to happen in a couple of sessions usually.
No. And each time I went to the places that offer like 6 emergency visit type things, that would almost make me feel worse, because we'd finally open up things and then I'd be dropped off. Like, sorry, I can't see you anymore. That's it. It's over. And it feels like a setup for failure.
Dr. Jennifer Swainson is a general adult psychiatrist in Edmonton, Alberta. In addition to her clinical work, Dr. Swainson teaches medical students and residents in psychiatry. She's also an active researcher with a particular focus on treatment-resistant depression. She's recently authored and co-authored several publications on this topic. Her other major research area is in the interactions between diet and mental health, and it's my real honor to have her join me on the show today to talk about complex treatment pathways for depression. Dr. Swainson, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Mark.
So I'm wondering if you can talk to me a bit about if we know what the average amount of or the average length of time, the average duration, I guess, of treatment that a patient would receive from a psychiatrist, if it's a one-off consultation or if it may take several years of a relationship with a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. And I think there is no one answer. I don't actually know what the average would be. It's quite variable depending on location and sort of care model of any sort of given geographic healthcare system. Certainly there are a number of people who would see a psychiatrist for a one-time consultation where the psychiatrist would provide some advice back to the family physician in terms of what the diagnosis is and giving advice for steps to take in treatment. And, you know, the idea with that is to allow a wider variety of people access to see a psychiatrist and to get that expert opinion. However, there are people that are more chronically unwell and their illnesses wax and wane and recur. And, you know, in those types of conditions, they may follow up with a psychiatrist over a long time period, over many years. The challenges come when someone doesn't respond to the first or the second treatment that a family doctor tries. And that's where, you know, the expertise of a psychiatrist can come in. Sometimes there's things diagnostically that we pick up that maybe would have been missed that would affect treatment course. Sometimes there's suggestions in terms of subtleties with medications, be it the dosing or the choice of medication or the combination of medications that we can provide advice on.
In Shelley's case, it eventually became apparent that she wasn't responding well to medication. Fortunately for her, she's been able to explore non-pharmaceutical options.
I have. I was fortunate enough to get into the Homewood program, the 8-week mood disorder program at Homewood in Guelph, and my insurance benefits covered that. It was so expensive. And there, within the first week, the doctor said to me, you have a lot of issues, but I think medications are useless for us to even try here. I want you to try ECT. So I had my first set of ECT treatments at Homewood, and we were shocked at how effective they were and how quickly they elevated my mood. And it was actually another revelation because I remember, so usually about the 10th treatment of a session of ECT treatments that I start feeling a difference. And it's not that something is there, it's that something is missing. It kind of started eliminating the despair and the darkness, and there was more room for light to come in. So I didn't know I could feel that way. I had never felt it before that first time. So I was just happy that there was a treatment modality that was there. It was rough. But
sure. Well, and there's a lot of stigma around electroconvulsive therapy, I think, that everybody thinks of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, right? And getting zapped. But that's not how it is, right?
That's not how it is. And I did lose friends. I actually had one friend say to me, if you do ECT, I will not be your friend anymore. And I couldn't understand why, because if I had my pancreas failing, they would have supported me in getting it fixed. If my kidney was failing, they would have been stood by my side. But no, if I was having my brain supported, they didn't see that as something that was something they could support.
Well, and I was going to say, so of course, memory loss is one of the most common side effects of ECT. Was that your experience?
Oh, to a bigger degree than normal. I was not one of the people who only had short-term memory loss. I was one of the like 5% who has long-term memory loss, and it still to this day continues. I don't remember my son growing up. That entire amount of memory has been wiped from my mind. I have situations where I lose entire days. I don't remember vacations. I don't remember going to restaurants, but we've kind of adjusted. I feel like it was a small price to pay to actually be able to continue to try to make more memories and hope that some of them stick.
So did it affect your ability to recall past memories or to encode new memories?
Both.
Yes, and I didn't realize the new memories one until I was back at work again and trying to be part of a team, and I was losing entire days, and I would see notes in my notebook from meetings, but the projects wouldn't get done because I would totally forget that day, and then someone would come to me 2 weeks later and say, where's that work? And I'd be like, nobody told me about it. And they'd be like, you were at the meeting. So it's been, it's been massive, and it's been a lot more than the normal average person who receives ECT gets.
So how did you were working for other people, for companies at this time. So how did your workplace support you, or did they, throughout this treatment journey?
There was one place I worked at for 13 years, and this was before everything kind of hit the fan. He was always very supportive, but I became a really tough employee to keep. There were many months where I would have to go off work. There were many days that I would miss out, and it just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And then it came to the point where you could see the pattern in my employment history that every 6 or 7 months I would be off work, and I would start a new job because I would leave a job because I was so afraid to tell them what was happening and that I wasn't being able to do what they needed. I was letting a lot of people down.
Why were you afraid to tell them what was happening?
I think, and this was about 15 years ago, I think I was still afraid to say that I was really good at what I did. I was a really great graphic designer, and I think I still am, but it takes me 24 hours to do something that only took half an hour before. My speed has really decreased, and just being able to connect, I can sit in front of my computer, I can have my programs open, but I can't remember how to do something that I know in my head I can do. But I was afraid to tell them because I think I still hoped I'd be able to continue working at these jobs that I loved. But nobody wants to pay someone that amount of money to do a logo when they could pay a quarter of that price with someone who could do it quickly.
So how do you know when things are starting to decline? Because, you know, for 20 years, you didn't even, that was just your normal, right? Until you eventually saw the light. But now it seems like you have a fairly sensitive indicator for when things are starting to go south again.
And I think that that's due to the amount of times I've been through this cycle. I consider myself lucky that it appears to be very cyclical for me. And I think that that might be the way it is for a lot of people. But until you've experienced it so many times, you don't really recognize how you function when you're doing well and how you function when you're not well. I notice early I have symptoms of I anger more quickly, and I'm not usually an angry person. I'm much more negative. I start sleeping less, but I have zero energy. I'm very irritable. And then my family starts noticing. And when my family starts telling me, we think that you need to call your doctor and it's time to get in for more treatment, it kind of dawns on me like, yeah, you're right. I haven't been functioning the way I need to. And then also thoughts of suicide start creeping in again. And I don't like those thoughts. I don't like them. I really don't want to die.
Yeah. Now I hope you appreciate how beautifully poignant and powerful that is, to be able to get to a point in your life where you're able to say that I can think about suicide, but I don't want to die.
I am really lucky, and I don't see suicide as so many people do. I know the dialogue is changing, but my dad used to think it was a coward's way out. Now when I speak and he comes to me speaking, he'll stand up at the end and say, this is my daughter. I used to think that she was just making excuses and she was sensitive and such, but he says, now I see that she is one of the strongest people I know, and she's been through so much, and she has fought through it, and she has advocated for herself, and she has gotten herself to a place where she's able to do this now and support her own sons.
How is your life now?
It's great because it's predictable in terms of my health, that it's predictable. I know what to expect. Obviously, I'm wishing and hoping that I never have to go through it again, but when it comes, if it comes, I've got such a great system and support group in place that it impacts my life much less. Mental health is definitely at the front and center of our family life and within our house and such. And I think that that's just how it unfolded with everything, but not in a bad way, in a good way. I feel like we're contributing to the dialogue and to what needs to happen. And otherwise, I love my home. I love my community. I love my family. We all live close to each other. Zach's growing up with his cousins. I'm really lucky, and that's the stuff I have to remember when I take a turn for the worse, is that I love all this stuff in my life, and I need to remember that even though I'm not feeling that love, it is there.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And you're such an inspiration to me and to so many other people, you and your entire family, being open about these issues and showing people that, look, sometimes this is, or often this is complicated and it's difficult and it's a long road, but not only can you get through it, you can do something good with it, which I'm thankful is exactly what you're doing.
Working on it. We're all works in progress. Sometimes it's really crappy. Sometimes it's beautiful.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Shelley. That's all the questions that I had for you today. But is there anything else that you wanted to add that you think we should include here?
I think that I've always said that I think we need to celebrate survivors more. We celebrate cancer survivors. We make them feel like warriors. We make them feel like, yes, you have been through so much. You've put your body through so much and you've come out as a hero on top. But we every time I finish a round of treatments, I take a picture of myself in front of the sign saying, oh, last treatment. And there's no celebration for me. People aren't sending me cupcakes. People aren't sending me casseroles. Nobody really steps in to help with the housework and things like that. And my fight was, I mean, I've never been through cancer, but my fight has been just as hard at times where I wanted things to end. But we do need to celebrate the people who survived this and lift them up and recognize the what they've been through in the same way.
I couldn't possibly agree more. I think it takes a lot to get through this. You know, I was talking to somebody else last week, I think it was, about the interesting phenomenon it's increasingly popular now or increasingly common, I should say now, to talk openly when you're struggling, while you're actively struggling with your mental health. But then it seems that when people find recovery, they're not as vocal about their recovery anymore, that because they feel good. So there's a perception that there's less need. I think there's actually more need once you get to the other side to reach back down into the cave and help other people. I think that's key.
Agreed. And I think that's where the hope comes from, too. This story has been written before and you can rewrite your own story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Shelley. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you. I'm glad that we were able to do this.
You too. I appreciate it. Thank you.
You've been listening to a special episode of So-Called Normal with Mark Hennick. If you like what you heard, share the episode with others. You can always follow Mark on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube, and Instagram at Mark Hennick. Otherwise, you might want to check out his website, markhennick.com. This special series of So-Called Normal has been produced by Mark Hennick and Eye Contact Productions. I'm Dave Trafford.
This episode of So-Called Normal is brought to you by an educational grant from Janssen, Inc. Mark Hennick and the producers of So-Called Normal are solely responsible for the content of the episode, and the views and opinions expressed in this episode do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of Janssen, Inc. The podcast content is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition, product, or treatment. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have read or seen in this podcast episode.